Good morning. Let's begin.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Come take your seat.
Getting a little burned up.
Well, that's why I played hooky yesterday.
No.
But now I kind of want to do what I can.
So this is perhaps a stupid question, but I'm curious if anyone else was up for the sunrise this morning, which was spectacular. Anybody? Anybody for the sunrise? There we go. Yesterday. There we are.
Yeah.
No, it was a spectacular sunrise, and it was wonderful to wake with the memory of last night's meal. I think we're all agreed it was truly spectacular yesterday. And the day only gets better. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Jancis Robinson. In her writing, Jancis conveys many things, wonderful things, what sophistication, wit, charm, enthusiasm, and a boundless love for wine and food and people. Her persona is unique. It is equal parts experience and curiosity. It is the professional and the consumer. It is the insider and the outsider. Of course, she's well known for her books and TV shows, for her column, and now her delightful website. How could you not want to read something that has sections entitled, Don't Quote Me? But though her list of accomplishments is long and impressive, I'm quite sure that she's only really just getting warmed up. I've been following you already on Twitter, on your website, and the amount of writing you've been doing just since being in Oregon is terrific. So it is wonderful and appropriate that Jancis is here this morning. She's a great friend to Oregon and to the IPNC specifically. I think 1988 was your first.
Yep.
I think you'll agree that she's really the dinner guest we always hope is going to show up. But today we're lucky that she's the moderator that we have with us. Ladies and gentlemen, Jancis Robinson.
Thank you very much. And so many congratulations to the organizers of IPNC for, I think, honestly, the very best dinner I've ever had for that number of people served from a tent so efficiently. And it was so delicious. It was great. I may be a good friend to Oregon Wine, I am, but I'm a relatively ignorant friend to Oregon Wine because, sadly, we don't see nearly enough Oregon Wine in Britain. So I enjoy this session very much because it teaches me a lot. And the idea behind this session is to explore the difference between place and winemaker or land and the hand. And it has sprung from this group of five wineries who are Lynn Penarash from Penarash Cellars, and Ted Castile, Bethel Heights, and Laurent Montolieu from Solena, Steve Derner from Christom, and Ken Wright from the eponymous wine cellars. And they're good friends, and over the years have sort of formalized their winemaking friendship into a group of winemakers known elegantly as Cellar Crawl. And they crawl each other's cellars, I'm told. Perhaps they can fill you in a bit more. They spend a lot of time in each other's cellars, basically, I think, doing a kind of mini steamboat and tearing each other's wines apart. Also traveling together, yeah, and exploring other wine regions and just keeping on learning and exploring and improving, which, of course, and in a cooperative way, which is the keynote of the Oregon wine industry. And they got one of their many experiments and sort of collaborative efforts was to take an experiment called 5x5. Five winemakers, each one gave up some grapes to share to each of the other winemakers. So they have five lots of wine made from the same five vineyards, making 25 lots in all. And what you have in front of you are two of those lots. And Lynn will be telling you later which the five vineyards are and how to approach the tasting. But first of all, we're going to have Ken give us a geology lesson, which I know I have on good authority is very interesting even to people who've lived here for years. Then Steve is going to give us a background on the history of collaboration in the Oregon wine industry. Laurent is going to discuss how the Oregon wine business is evolving. Ted will tell us how, why, when the group was founded and what it gets up to. And Lynn is going to tell us in a bit more detail about the 5x5 experiment and give you some pointers for the lovely wines that are on the table. Thank you.
Thank you. Am I on? I'm on.
You're on,
Ken. I'm on. My role today is to talk about the influence of geology and how it is evident in our wines. We all know that the health of the vineyards is affected by the uptake of mineral. And for me personally and many others, we believe that what is expressed in that glass, both in aroma and flavor, is also mostly dependent on the mother rock where it's grown. So we're going to talk about how the mother rock got here. In the beginning, before the pioneers.
Deeper.
I need a Charlton Heston voice on this one. I have this map up because I want to first talk about the creation of the very base material that we have in Oregon. Can you see my laser, I hope? Where we meet California existed 200 million years ago, but from there, we went at a diagonal up to Idaho. So this half of the state, the northwest half of Oregon, was ocean. The state of Washington did not exist. That was ocean. Over these 200 million years, we've had the Juan de Fuca plate, which is our nearby maritime plate, subducting under the continental plate. So it would just plunge underneath. The dense mother rock goes on down, it slips under, subducts, and keeps going east underneath the continental plate. But the soft material that you would walk on if you were scuba diving on the ocean bed floor, it gets sheared off as that plunges underneath. And that material gets added or pillowed. And so we created in that 200 million years this half of the state, all of the state of Washington. And we're still going west. We're creating coastline every moment of every day right now, unlike the East Coast, which is quite quiet and, in fact, eroding. We have some terrific real estate opportunities yet to come out here. Yes, hopefully, you know, if medical science really, really comes on, we might realize those opportunities. But so we will, in fact, end up about 120 miles further out in the ocean, and the U.S. coastline in 80 million years will be about 120 miles further out, and then it'll come back into the San Andreas Fault. Okay? So lots more land to be created yet. After this creation, it was all marine sediments. So everything underneath, the point of that talk was that everything underneath is marine sediments. In just 20 million years ago, the Blue Mountains, which are here near Idaho, in the east part of the state, were very, very violent. In fact, they created the greatest amount of basalt on planet Earth. There's nowhere you can go on this planet and find more basalt than was created by the activity of these volcanoes. And in fact, there was so much material created that it came west across the state. Those of you who know where Bend is, in the very middle of the state, when you're there, you're standing on 2,500 feet of basalt, a half a mile of basalt that came from that chain. And in fact, it came all the way across the state because there was no impediment. At this time, there was no Cascade Chain, there was no Rainier, there was no Mount Hood, there was no Shasta. And so that material came all the way across, and it covered us in the Willamette Valley with a mantle of basalt that is over the original marine sediments. It's a thin layer. Essentially, where we are, it was about 1,000 feet. And so since then, it's been relatively quiet. You've had the Missoula floods and such, but this mantle has been eroding. And in our area, we are now left with vestiges of the mantle, and you know them well. They would be the Dundee Hills. They would be the Eola Hills. They would be the Chehalem Ridge. That's what's left of the flood. And those, that volcanic material that's there is not from underneath. There's never been volcanic activity here, ever. That's what's left of the mantle. And so we live in a very violent place. That's 1980. Yeah, it's not very long ago that St. Helens blew up. I mean, amazingly violent. And it will happen again. The cascade chain is, the cascades are the Juan de Fuca plate coming back up violently. That's what the cascades are. It's the plate coming back up, and it's still coming back up, and it's gonna blow again. This shows the a shot of the Missoula floods, the time of the ice age 12,000 years ago, where glacial Lake Missoula was created at the Canadian-Montana border. This was essentially a half mile high a wall of ice that held back a massive lake of water. It would form and break numerous times, and when it did break, that water would rush through Idaho, southeast Washington, where it created what's called the Scablands. Essentially, all the physical features of southeast Washington were erased by the water that came through. The volume of water was so great that, in fact, at the time it was hitting here in the Scablands, it was still 200 feet high and moving at 80 miles an hour. And people were around. Scary. Glad I wasn't there. And it continued. That wall of water continued, and it cut the gorge very, very deeply. As you see it today, it exists like that because of that water rushing through that channel. And when it would come all the way to Portland, it would slam up against the west hills of Portland, and then it would go south because there's lower elevation. It would fill the Willamette Valley with water, creating a temporary lake, Lake Allison. And again, this happened several times. It was a temporary lake because the source wasn't consistent. It was this occasional flooding. But we do find what's really fun. Anybody who farms here knows that when they're farming, around the 300 to 450 foot elevation line, you find lots of debris. You find glass. I mean, there is no native glass here. Zero. There is no, quartz, granite. It does not exist here naturally. But you find pieces and shreds all over the topically at this elevation because it was washed in and then left as a debris line. And, in fact, there are some massive pieces like this one. This is a 160-ton piece of erratica from Montana that is in Sheridan, so it's actually south, out Highway 18 going to the coast from here. And this, I mean, I remember seeing this photo many, many years ago and thinking, I don't care how crazy the volume of water was, how does a piece of rock like that get here? And Ray Wells, who's our leading parent material specialist in the United States, told me that, well, it didn't come like that. It was, in fact, encased in ice, and it floated here. People who know this study well will tell you that if you were in Portland, you could have heard that roar of water coming a half hour before it hit. And it's just a phenomenal event. And this is just a shot showing this is an inset of the valley, a little closer showing the new AVAs that have been created. Many of them, this is here because when they were devised, the new AVAs, a lot of them are based upon parent material. The lines drawn to define them were based upon parent material, again, because of the thought that it's that mineral, that special mineral from that location that influences the expression in the wine. This shows sedimentary soils in our area. This is Yamhill Carlton. You can see how sandy they are. They're incredibly well-drained, a very light in color. They don't hold moisture well. Even on the surface, you can see how lightly colored the surface is. You can see the vines don't look to be very vigorous. They're held back by the soil. In the wine, we see a little less fruit-driven than the basalt areas. We start to see a rustic quality, some spice, and also floral qualities. In volcanics, this would be the Dundee Hills. You can see that the soil is much richer, darker, a lot more clay, more water-holding capacity. And the vines show it. Even the surface is darker. The vines show the vigor. You can see compared to that last slide, huge difference. The characteristics in the Yola Hills, which are basaltic, you start to see much more fruit focus, darker profile, very dark blue to black profile. Dundee Hills tends to be more in the red fruit spectrum, but still, it is basalt, and it's still focused on fruit. Oop. And now my wonderful friend, Steve Dorner, who slept in a boat last night, is going to get up and talk to you guys.
Well, Ken started you out about 200 million years ago. I'm going to look back, but not quite that far. I'm going to go back about 45 years. As you all know, David Lett was our founding father, if you will, of vinifera in the Willamette Valley, and he just passed away last winter. So we just wanted to give him a tribute because he really is why we're all here. Anyway, David was not much of a collaborator to begin with because he was the only one here, so there's nobody to collaborate with except perhaps his wife. But soon, one by one, he was followed by other early folks. Dick Erath was one of them who came not long after David. Dick Ponzi. I'm missing a lot of them, too, so unfortunately, I didn't bring a slide of all the people who were responsible for the early days, but there were a number of them. Myron Redford. They had to be very innovative back then. As you can see, I think Myron's using the truck jack from his truck to make the press work. Myron's probably not here, but I'd like to ask him. He's probably still using it, actually. Anyway, as more and more of them came, they realized, and the tradition that they left us, and a lot of them are still around, was that they got more accomplished by working together than by doing it individually, and that's sort of the basis of our group here. So we certainly didn't invent this collaborative, nature of our industry. It was there pretty much from the beginning. I remember this slide for a while because although there are a couple people missing out of that was pretty much the whole industry back then. And there's another slide coming up that's not even of today. It's much, much later, but you'll see how it has grown. Anyway, this is just a list of some things that I think would not have happened had it not been for working together. I'm going to go through each one of these a little bit, slightly more detail. I'm just going to read them off right now. But the land use laws of 1972, labeling regulations happened in 77, the Wine Advisory Boards formed in 79, the Steamboat Conference was also that year. This event, the International Pinot Noir Celebration, started in 1987, and then the Salud Barrel Auction was 92, Pinot Camp, 2000, and then more recently the new AVAs, which were also done in a cooperative nature. Going back to that top one on the list, the land use laws, this is actually a picture of Bethel Heights Vineyard, and literally it was kind of destined to be a trailer park farm had it not been... for the land use laws that made it very difficult, if not impossible, to do that. So it's those laws have really helped keep a lot of agricultural land from being developed into condos or whatever. Oregon wine labeling laws, 1977. A couple of the features of that was that we had the most restrictive labeling laws in the country. 90% of the variety had to be, or the fruit had to be from 90% of the stated variety on the label. The national standard, the federal standard at the time was only 51%. Now the national standard is 75%, so we're still way ahead of it, and I think that we just shamed the rest of the country into going to 75%. Also, there was never, or at least since this law was passed in 1977, you could never use place names on a label like, Hardy Mountain Burgundy or, White Chablis or something. There was always had to be very accurate in the labeling. Often a lot of these sort of landmark things too were started by individuals or a couple groups of individuals, but it almost always took, the consensus from the majority of the industry to get them done. Wine Advisory Board, another kind of interesting formation that we imposed on ourselves, the highest tax of any known self-imposed tax, and that was to support half of it went for research and half of it goes to marketing. And that's still in existence today and serves us pretty well, I think. Steamboat was started in 1979, again conceived by four people actually, but has morphed into a big, very good conference just for winemakers, pretty technical. Everyone has to bring at least one wine to taste in a very formal setting, and you critique each other's wines. And it's often pretty brutal, too, because they were asked to be very honest. But I think a lot has been learned at this conference. Of course, this is also open to the whole international community. It's not just an Oregon thing, but it was started here. This is the same conference after the serious part. The guy in the forefront on the right there is James Halliday. He does happen to be a wine writer, which are discouraged from coming to this so that the winemakers will be a bit more honest. But he's a legitimate winemaker himself, and so he was allowed to come. So he's a bit of an exception, but he promised not to do any writing about all the flawed wines that he tasted there. This event first started in 1987, and again, it took great amounts of cooperation to make it happen. And there's both Steamboat and IPNC now have copycat events all over the world. This is the oldest one, I'm sure, and I can do the math, I guess 1987 is about 22 years old or something. Salud Barrel Auction was started in 1992 by some industry people and some healthcare professionals. Every year, through donations by about 50 different wineries as well as corporate sponsors, we raise more or less $500,000 to give back to the workers that work our fields. So that's been a very cooperative and successful organization.
6,000 people.
They serve 6,000 people. A lot of it, too, by the way, is preventative care. So the dollars really go a long ways. Pinot Camp is another thing that started in more recently. Well, it's still old now. It was started in 2000. That's another 50 wineries, all hosting industry trade people primarily, restaurateurs, sommeliers, retailers, and stuff like that. And you can imagine trying to get 50 hosts to work together. It's kind of a challenge, but it's often people's favorite event that get flown all over the world. They love our event more than any. And the more recent thing, as Ken alluded to, these new appellations were formed in a pretty cooperative way, actually. It was started many years before, and people felt like it was too early, so it got postponed. And eventually there's enough consensus that it went forward. And the AVAs were worked on first sort of collectively, and then each AVA kind of submitted their own, but all pretty much simultaneously. And it's still very controversial. You know, even today there's a lot of stuff going around about whether or not it's valid or not. And I was one of the ones who was a bit skeptical about the timing. Certainly the terroir is valid and the AVAs are valid. It's just a matter of time. Maybe we can't define them real accurately. Some of us think, some of us do. But time certainly will make them more obvious what the differences are and whatnot. And part of this experiment is to do that as well. And even in places where the terroir has been, talked about for centuries, there's still debate over which one is contributes what. So it's not surprising that there's still a little bit of debate over this, but still it is done very collectively. So I think that's really an attribute. And this slide is actually a group similar to ours, only a little smaller, that did a similar experiment. Lynn and Ted and Terry from Bethel Heights were part of that, as well as Harry Peterson Nedry from Chehalem, and they did a similar trading fruit thing. So we certainly didn't invent this. In fact, our collaboration has been going on for about 12 years, but it's based on a lot of people who were doing this before us. Here's that second slide I wanted you to see. Now, this isn't recent either. This is 1994, and there are notable people missing from that picture, but more or less, this is the entire industry at the time. Today, unfortunately, we can't fit our whole industry in a picture any longer, but I still think that the legacy of working together has stuck with us and allowed things like this to take place. So I'm going to hand it over to Laurent, and he'll let you know what all this collaboration has done from a production side.
Thanks, Steve. I'm just going to spend a very few minutes to try to show you a little bit the immense progress that has been made in the wine industry. I think you all are a testimony to, you know, the quality of what has happened in Oregon. You've been consistently coming to IPNC and visiting all of us here in Oregon. It's been wonderful. Viticulturally, I think it's been the most amazing challenge, and but also the greatest success probably. If you now wander the vineyards, which I know you've done yesterday, you probably see some amazing trellis system, some viticultural that competes with the very best vineyards in the world. One of the aspects particularly is the trellis. I think that through all the vineyards, or most of the vineyards that you would be going through in Oregon, you see very vertical shoot positioning within a very tight trellis system. That's not only beauty farming. You know, obviously it looks very good, and believe me, the vines don't have the tendency to go upright. They want to go every which way. So to keep them nice and tidy is not only beautiful, but most importantly to us, it allows us to control the quality. It allows us to control the vigor. As the shoots go straight up, at some point they get hedged. And when you send a very clear signal to the vine, when you hedge it at once, and 90 to 95% of the shoots have been hedged at the same time, it sends a very clear hormonal signal to the vine saying, stop growing, start putting reserves into your little berries, start ripening those seeds, start making babies, essentially. So ripen the fruit, which is what, you know, we're looking for. So that's one of the things that I think you'll see throughout. Tighter and tighter spacing. In Oregon, we were, I think, on the front edge of, you know, adhering a little bit to tighter spacing. I remember when I first got here in 87, the spacing would be, you know, 10 by 5, 10 by 6. I mean, a lot of very wide spacing. Now I think everybody has agreed that, you know, a little tighter spacing, somewhere around 1,200 to 2,000 plants per acre, is more appropriate. And so we have, you know, enhanced, I think, viticulturally in that sense as well. One of the things that, you know, we are pretty proud here as the five of us to have contributed slightly is talking about the crop level. Crop level is what really gives us as winemakers the greatest control over the final quality. And what was admitted from Burgundy, because of course that's the experience of with Pinot Noir, is that the thinning, did I say it right? I'm not talking about doing sins, but dropping crop, right? So the dropping of crop, I should use that word, the dropping of crop is done at a particular time in Burgundy, which is usually around color change. And that's what was admitted here. We, as five wineries, did an experiment to figure out the timing on when you can drop crop. And we've proven by about 4 years of consecutive experiment, not only in the vineyard but making the wine, that we can extend that period from right after set all the way to color change. That's giving us about 40 days more to actually do that operation, therefore being able to do it better. And as we do it earlier, we can improve the quality of the final fruit. So that was a pretty interesting discovery for all of us. And we did this experiment 4 years in a row, and now I think that it's been admitted throughout the industry in Oregon that, you know, we can do that drop of crop way, way earlier. So that was a pretty critical thing. It was important for us to do this because also we have to work in cooperation with the growers when we are just a winemaker and we buy fruit. So we have to be able to tell the grower, you know, you have this amount of time to do that operation that is really critical to us. And one of the steps that we've put in place, and again, I think Oregon was on the forefront of that aspect of buying grapes by the acre instead of buying grapes by the ton. We go to a grower and we say, we're going to pay you so much per acre. So January 1st, the growing season has not started. The grower already knows what he's going to be making per acre that year. And that was a very important part of, again, qualitative advantages and qualitative rise of the whole Pinot Noir industry here in Oregon, is being able to control our destiny as winemakers by controlling the per acre yields and the per acre production and so on. So that's I think that was a pretty important step in the life of the Oregon wine industry. You know, you saw the Myron with the crank there. I think the other thing in production that has been pretty amazing is you can go pretty much through any winery in Oregon, you would actually see some very, I wouldn't say elaborate, but very simple, but also very well-defined and very well-positioned equipment that allows to handle Pinot Noir in the best way and the most gentle way. So most of us now have, you know, sorting table allows us to take anything that we don't want out of the grapes prior to destemming. Some of us even sort right after. But the minimum that you'll find is always very, very gentle handling of the fruit and very qualitative notion. So I've seen the same kind of receiving line that we, most of us, have in Oregon now being kind of imitated throughout the world. So it's pretty interesting for us to realize that that we've done that. One of the concept of gravity, gravity flow winery, where you you know, you try to treat the fruit as gently as possible, has been developed throughout Oregon. Whether you are on the side of the hill or not, I think a lot of us have figured out that we can utilize forklifts. So there's a lot of forklifts that bring the fruit up and down to replicate gravity, which has been something that most people now are using in Oregon. So just a couple of things that I think have made a pretty big difference in the kind of rise of Pinot Noir in Oregon. So I'll let Ted kind of continue on the subject.
Before I start, I just want to note parenthetically that I'm the Bethel Heights contingent here. Actually, there are three of us, and it was going to have been a little awkward for all of us to be sitting in the same chair up here. But my brother Terry was our winemaker until 2005. He's been slow to step by Parkinson's and has gone into at least semi-retirement. And our wines now are made by my nephew, Ben, sitting right here. And he actually made our wines for the experiment in 06. And the vintage is 06 that sits in front of you. So just to note that, I'm just a grape guy. Okay.
And we blame when we don't like the wines.
and I'm just up here to briefly introduce our group and where we came from, how we got together, that sort of thing. And it's been about 13 years now that we've been crawling together. Crawl is kind of a weird word, I know, but it was invented by Lynn, as I remember, probably about halfway through the life of our group to this point, and gave it a little more of a sense of activity. Is it just a tasting group is what we were in the beginning, but now we're a crawl, and we're doing a lot more different kinds of stuff together as a consequence. Everybody up here today is an immigrant, as a lot of people in our industry are. It came from somewhere else. I'm an exception in a way, but no, because Terry and I were born in Oregon, but we immediately left and never came back until we decided to get into the biz here in 1977. So. Laurent, also a bit of an exception in that he came to the Willamette Valley from Southern Oregon, where he helped to found the Bridgeview Winery, but it does help to account for that funny accent that he has. So. I was thinking, you know, a couple days ago when I was getting organized to talk for 5 minutes up here about what's the most important defining feature of our group and why we've lasted as long as we have, and I think it basically comes down to a sense of trust and honesty among us, willingness to tell the truth. It reminds me of my recently visited by our grandkids from Chicago, and Owen is 4 years old, and his little sister, the little toddler, is a year and a half old. And whenever she fills her diaper, and everybody begins to notice some weird aromas in the room, Owen always sticks his nose in the air, and he says, "What's that smell?" And that's sort of like what we do for each other, in the sense that in the sense that, you know, when Steve, for instance, we're crawling through his cellar and he takes us to his most prized barrel and his best wine and sticks the thief in it and shares it around, and everybody begins to detect something a little weird going on in there, we all feel obliged to say, "What's that smell?" Our group actually grew out of, in 1997, Laurent was asked, I guess, by some Burgundians who who are planning a Polet, which is kind of a convention of Burgundians that happens periodically. They invite people from sort of out of state to come in. Anyway, he organized a group of Oregonians. There must have been 10 or 12 of us all together to go to Burgundy to present Oregon wines to this group of distinguished winemakers. And Ken and Steve couldn't go, but the rest of us went, and in addition to other people. And Lynn and I and Terry and Laurent all ended up in the same car. And so we kind of formed a little coalition over there and really had a marvelous time together. As soon as we sort of run the gauntlet of 200 Burgundians tasting our wines and politely saying, the hospitality was rolled out for us. We visited all of the best cellars and domains, had many wonderful meals together, discussing what we were learning and all the rest of it. And as a consequence and out of the experience, as we returned to Oregon, we decided to start a kind of informal collaboration among us. And that was the beginning of the cellar crawl. And it got off to a very healthy start, because 1997 turned out to be a very challenging year, a wet vintage, lots of discussions about what to do about water and wine and that sort of thing. And it was the beginning of something that was in the, you know, to start with, just visiting each other's cellars. Then out of that, over time, we started visiting the cellars of all of our colleagues whom we respected. We then have gone now to wine regions all over the West Coast here in the United States, going through cellars. And over time, the tastings really became mainly a kind of occasion for collaboration and innovation. We'd be in somebody's cellar somewhere, you know, and this person was very proud of their wines and all that, and, you know, have thieved some wine out and is drooling down their leg while we're over in a corner somewhere talking about our next experiment or whatever we were doing, which was kind of rude, I have to admit. But that's the kind of thing that started to happen. We did some big experiments together. Laurent has alluded to the crop management experiment that really helped to establish the crop management protocols for our whole industry. And, of course, this thing in front of you today is probably the largest and most elaborate and most difficult thing we've done to date. So it's been a lot of fun, and it continues. And it is part of the culture of our industry that people do this. We're not the only group. But Lynn is now going to come up here and tell you about this particular experiment. Lynn is, among other things, in addition to being, what'd she say, really hot, she's also one of the most respected and successful winemakers in our industry. And for us, she's really functioned in many ways as our kind of sergeant major. Lynn is the one who gets us to get the work done. And all the way along, especially in this project, it was Lynn's prodding that got us to the point where you have these wines in front of you today. So with that, Lynn will tell you what we're doing here.
It's really hard to get any respect from these guys. You can see why. I love being able to play cleanup because they all get their little barbs in here, but I'm the final speaker today, so breathe a sigh of relief. There's not going to be much more. But with that said, I get my opportunity up here, and they have no revenge. We're a great group of friends. I think this was a great project for us to take on. It's not really an experiment as much as it was a project. I think it really tested our friendship over time. Trying to organize this and get everyone on the same page was really difficult. It sprung from actually a ride down to Chavern, Oregon, in Ken's pickup truck. And we had all been playing old-timer softball. And we got into Ken's truck, and it was a big monster truck at the time that it fit all six of us. I think we were in the truck. And as we were driving down, we started talking to each other about, well, what do you do, and why do you do that? Are you crazy? You do that? Why? That makes no sense. Steve, you don't even go over and check your fermentations? Why not? He goes, oh, I never look at them. They're fine by themselves. And so we started challenging each other. And so Laurent did a spreadsheet that we all filled out with our very, very strongly held beliefs in the way wine should be made, and then we spent an entire session picking each other apart, and to the point where we were getting upset with each other because I can't believe you do this or you believe this. But it really made us examine why we do what we do and does it really make a lot of sense or not. So from there, after that big pickup truck ride down, we were thinking of other ways we could get together and challenge ourselves yet again. And this is the 5x5 experiment. What this meant was each one of us had to choose a vineyard property that we felt strongly about for some particular reason. For Ken, it was maybe the AVA, the geology, the soil differences. We all had reasons for the particular site. But it was also a challenge because we each had to find a vineyard property that was large enough to give each other a ton and a quarter of fruit. That's a total of 7 tons we gave up for the experiment you're tasting in front of you. And so, you know, some of us are challenged by the fact we didn't have a vineyard big enough to give up 7 tons. So in this experiment, we each chose one vineyard. There are 5 vineyards here. Unfortunately, because of logistics, that would have meant that the IPNC would have had to set out over 6,500 glasses for you today. So Whitney wasn't really game for that for some reason, so she required us to pare this down. So we pared it down to 2 flights today. The other group yesterday had 2 flights that are different from yours, so if you chatted and cheated, you're wrong. It's 2 different vineyards. You don't know what the vineyards are. We don't know the order of what's in front of you either. I can only tell you this. There's 1 flight, comes from 1 particular vineyard. The 2nd flight comes from another different vineyard. I will also tell you, of the 5 vineyards we worked with, Ken chose his Abbott Claim Vineyard, which is from the Yamhill Carlton AVA. Steve chose one of the estate vineyards called Eileen. It's in the Eola Amity Hills. Laurent chose Willakaya, which is also in the Eola Amity Hills. Terry, Ted, and Ben chose their own home site, the Southeast Block from Bethel Heights Vineyard, which is Eola Amity Hills. And I chose a vineyard called Leah from the Chehalem Mountain AVA. So that's just a little bit of the logistics in front of you. Sorry, I have to look at my notes to make sure I'm telling you everything you need to know. So basically what we did here is we started with the same canvas. I like to say all of us started with the same canvas. We all got the same 1 1/4 ton of fruit. And we took great pains to make sure that everybody got a section of the vineyard that was similar. So we mixed boxes. They would go pick a box. It would go to Laurent. They'd go pick a box. It went to me, to Ken. So everybody was getting pieces. If there was any kind of topography change in the vineyard, you were getting that reflected in each of the lots that we worked together with. So the guys like to say we started with the same canvas, and for some reason they imagined like a naked model as they were painting their picture with the wines. And I never really saw that. I only saw the fruit bowl, and I just didn't understand as they wax on about how beautiful it was and how elegant and all this other stuff. I'm like, it's a picture of a fruit, guys. What's going on here?
Are we really that simple?
Yes. So we had great discussions. It was fun because as we made the wines, we all chose to make them the way we felt they needed to be made. The difference is here, we did have to make some decisions that logistically would have been too challenging to overcome. So the first decision we had to make that was uniform was we all chose, each winemaker who owned that vineyard or participated in that vineyard got to choose the picking date. So I chose the picking date for the vineyard that I was working with, and all the guys got the fruit from that vineyard site. Now, we didn't pick all the vineyards on the same day. We just chose to pick our particular vineyard site on one day and disseminate the fruit. It would have been impossible to get our growers to pick 1 1/4 tons over a period of 5 different days. So we had to kind of come up with some of the areas we were willing to compromise and some of the areas that we could actually do as we please. But pretty much from there on out, it was do as you wanted, make the wine the way you felt it needed to be made. So that was one of the challenges we took on. And then from there, we tasted it out throughout the entire year. And believe me, tasting 25 wines at a time and then having the varied discussion usually took us a good 9-10 hours. It was quite a commitment in time and energy to get this project off the ground. So from there, I think I've given you everything you need to know to get started on the experiment. So we're going to taste. It is from the 2006 vintage. Go ahead and taste for a few moments and see if you can understand, one, you're looking to see maybe if you know the vineyards, and two, who made the wines.
say which flight is which.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. Just so we all start off on the same page, because yesterday there was a bit of confusion. What we call flight one here is the back flight. You can see on your placemats it says flight one. It's the back flight. The flight in front of you, directly in front of you, is flight two.
Should I just give people a reminder of which vineyards these possibly could be? They are the southeast block from Bethel Heights in Eola Amity Hills, the Eileen Vineyard from Christom in Eola Amity Hills, the Abbott Claim Vineyard, Ken Wright's Eola. Yamhill Carlton. Leah Vineyard, Penna Ash, and Chehalem Mountain. Or Willakaya Vineyard from Selena in Eola Amity Hills. All 2006s, yeah? And something which might help a few things fall into place is that the same. Each winery is represented vertically. You see what I mean? So, yeah, both of the first two wines are made by the same winemaker, both of the last two wines by the same winemaker, etc. People still need more time? Or Nick Mills says yes, but he's shrugging his shoulders, so they're okay. Tell you what would be interesting. Consider whether you find it's easier to make a stab at who made what or which vineyard it is, i.e. is it easier to make guesses vertically or horizontally? Who finds it easier to work out who made which wine? And who finds it easier to try to work out which vineyard? There's a kind of left-right split here. I don't know. Well, that's very, very interesting. Maybe we should go, what do you think, go for vineyard first?
Sure.
So maybe would some of those people who thought that the vineyard identification was easier... I mean, I don't know, or I could. I think at this point yesterday, I just said my own impressions. I know which the vineyards are, but I don't know which the winemakers are. The winemakers don't know anything but have a pretty good idea. They've been thinking about things. I think you do know which vineyards, though, this today, don't you? Yeah. should I just, while the last... I must say I thought that flight one generally seemed flight one, the one furthest away from everyone, we accept that, was sort of lighter in every way, certainly in terms of colour and intensity. And the acidity seemed more marked on flight one to me, whereas flight two was sort of darker in every way and more direct in every way and a little bit heavier in the mouth, less obvious acid for me. Flight one, number one, was pretty pale, rather light nose, very vigorous acidity. And for me, it was quite a shock after tasting all those 2006s last night, because it seemed much lighter for an 06. But it's very refreshing. Two kind of herbal, savory aspects on the nose, some red fruits. Again, I was picking up, relative to all the 2006s from last night, sort of notable acidity on the palate, and very, very fine tannins at the end. Three, a little hint of sweet oak on the nose, then kind of dried grass kind of flavors, rather nice and intriguing, mid-weight. Again, picked up on some acidity. Four was richer, headier than most, more opulent, with kind of plush tannins. Quite an intense wine for this flight. Five, a kind of lifted nose, a little bit of gaminess, then sweet round on the palate, and some sort of chewy, quite chewy tannins on the finish. Flight two, sudden sort of one, it, even the first wine, huge contrast to anything in flight one. Sort of black fruits, ripe, lush, little, sort of almost a hint of damp animal fur. Definitely very, very ripe, round, sweet, acid much less obvious. Second one, a bit of mocha, a little toastiness, rich, sweet, yet with good balancing acidity, and quite racy compared to the other some of the two wines in the second flight. Three, very aromatic wine, rather transparent fruit, very sort of deft touch, savoury, and another racy wine. Four, very dark, heady black fruits, pure, fruity, direct, a sort of fruit essence there, sort of kapow between the eyebrows. But a nice bit of tannin and acid tucked in for the future on the finish. Five, relatively dark, intense, very full-on black cherry essence on the nose, I thought. And again, like one, slightly chewier tannins on the finish than the others, as was the fifth wine in flight one for me. But anyway, that's my duty done. Who's going to have a stab at the vineyard? Or vineyard, just one of the vineyards? Or the area?
Offer a prize.
A prize. Free subscription to JancisRobinson.com. When in doubt. Right. Oh. One of you two. Nick? You want to have a go? I think we've got some mics, haven't we? Either would do. Or even just an AVA as a start. We haven't had panel. Should we find out what the panel people think first?
Are you ready to take the plunge?
No, I actually don't know any of them, but I just think what's interesting, and underneath all of that, I think the spectrums that you were talking about is right. The first one seemed a little bit perhaps lighter on the aromatics, but for me, there was a little bit more iron and there was a little bit more sort of phenolic power for me actually in the first flight. The second flight was just a little bit more logical, maybe slightly finer in terms of the line, and that sort of, I don't know the appellations at all, but I would probably say that I'm going to go for a stab and say that the first one felt a little bit more volcanic in the sense that it had some iron and the first flight, sorry.
Flight one, the one furthest away from you.
Yep, the furthest away, yeah. No, I got that.
Sorry.
And the second one just seemed like maybe it's a little bit sandier, a bit loamier, but just in terms of texture, not in terms of anything else.
Should we hear? Let's hear from the panelists.
Given what we discussed, can you hear me through that mic?
Yep, absolutely.
Given what we discussed earlier about the effect of parent material, would you, to me, my impression would be that the flight closest to you, flight two, is more fruit focused.
Yep.
Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay. In our earlier discussion about parent material, remember we discussed that basaltic sites, as a rule, you know, there's lots of variation, but as a rule, they tend to be more fruit-focused. So that should be a hint, I think, to everybody in the room, that the flight that's closest to you, flight two, might be basaltic. And so knowing the locations of the vineyards, that's a clue there. And the other flight, to me, would be either sedimentary or transitional, where you have a mix. And so you see a very, very different profile. A bit lighter, but in a little, maybe a little bit gamier, earthier, as a whole.
Any other thoughts from any other panel members? Should we just have a mic over there? Was the question, how far apart are the three Eola Amity Hill sites, yeah.
Well, two of them are within a stone's throw if you're a really good arm. But then the third one is, at the northern end, so it's a bit further away.
So which are those, then? Which are the two that are within a stone's throw?
Well, the southeast block from Bethel Heights and the Eileen from Christom are very close to each other.
Thank you.
And the Willakaya would have been the one that is a bit further.
So Willakaya is at the northern end,
right.
Therefore not as 100% classic Eola, Amity Hills?
Perhaps, yes. I never like to commit.
It would be helpful, I think, for me anyway, to have a word from the winemakers about why they chose the vineyard, you know, just really quickly, the vineyard, and what you were striving for in the wine to be able to identify the winemaker and the vineyard.
Off you go.
Okay. I chose Aventlane, the reason being that it's on the it's just east of Carlton. It's a beautiful small ridge line that, that I share with Tony Soder and a few others. And the reason we chose it is that the it's really just a big face, a very even face that doesn't have undulation, and so your depth to parent material is extremely consistent. So your soil is 30 to 36 inches deep, and then you're into the parent material, and so the performance of the vines is extremely consistent, which it isn't in many other sites. And hoping that I could give to my compadres the same fruit, you know, to each of them, so that that had consistency, and let then the winemaking take over beyond that, I thought it was the best site to choose.
Well, Nikki, yeah, I have to.
How
did you handle it?
Winemaking.
When it comes to winemaking, and for me, I'm not trying to model the wine. To me, it's all about farming to get expression. You farm to get expression from your fruit. You farm at an extremely high level, whatever it takes to get those vines to perform. And then what you receive, that's your gift. Okay? Everything great in wine is received from the vineyard. It doesn't happen in the winery. And so my job is to be transparent, is to learn how not to get in the way, which is very difficult to not get in the way.
I would ditto a lot of what Ken said, and yet we make wine very differently. We're both trying to get out of the way, and yet we do things differently, so it's all about definition. But again, as Ken mentioned, we didn't set out to make this an experiment so much as just let's trade some fruit and see what happens, and this is what it's turned into. But the main goal was to find something uniform enough that would satisfy, you know, our appetite to all make wine from the same fruit. So, and that's primarily why we chose our Eileen vineyard in the estate, because it was quite a uniform slope, same clone and everything, so that we would ensure that it would be the same material that everybody got. But it's our high elevation vineyard, and just turns out we were lucky because it was a warm year that I think that was probably our best site that year, but we didn't know that going into it. But yeah, I kind of agree with Ken that I tried to I actually handled all five vineyards identically, well, with the exception of maybe acid adjustment. But in terms of oak regime, I used some whole clusters. I kept that constant across the board. But I think other people chose to look at each vineyard site and altered their winemaking based on what they saw. So I was just trying to sort of give my kind of standard winemaking to all five of them to.
For me, I chose Wolakaya because of the consistency of the site. Also, the excitement that I had seen from this the first few years of this particular vineyard. It's been developed really to what I consider the best viticultural practices. And it's a transition area where you have some of the influence of the Missoula flood that Ken has been describing, and lots of rocks. It doesn't look like Chateauneuf, but pretty dang close. So lots of fracture rocks on top. Really stressful on the vine, and so I really enjoy that. So I thought it'd be fun to share that particular block. On the winemaking side, you know, I did what Ken has been saying. We're all trying to, I think, express the quality of the site first and foremost. But obviously, the wines are very different, which is exciting. For me, the greatest challenge was the size of the fermenter. I'm not really used to having the 1.25-ton size, and so the wine had difficulty reaching the kind of temperature that I usually like to do, so probably a little bit less extractive for me than in a normal size fermenter. That was about the biggest challenge. And as Steve mentioned, I mean, I don't know if mentioned the percentage of New York, but I was about 50% New York on our wines.
Our our wine is, I think, in or at least the vineyard part is a bit of an outlier in that it's actually a block of a 50-acre vineyard, our home estate vineyard, Bethel Heights, located right in the center of Viola Hills. It's very basalt. It's 3 feet of red clay soil over fractured rock. It was planted in 1979, and that's the other thing. It's by far the oldest stand represented here. It's one of our legacy blocks, which are just now beginning to fall to phylloxera. They were all planted on their own roots, Pomard clone. Spacing is 8 by 10 or 10 by 8, which is the old California spacing that I brought with me from Davis. And therefore 535 vines per acre. And in order to increase quality at that wide spacing, what we've done is to create a very tall trellis and have employed a Scott Henry training system, which is a vertically divided canopy, which gives you about nine feet of green leaves. And nonetheless, we still crop it between 2 and 2.25 tons per acre. So it's been there a long time. It's beginning to show a few wounds. Probably in 06, though, it was much healthier than it is today. On the winemaking side, I think we make wine an awful lot like everybody else does up here, especially given the limitations in terms of the fermentation vessel and that we could employ. The southeast block is 5.5 acres, so we ended up with about, 40% of the fruit left. We made our commercial southeast block in a much larger container, and the wine tastes quite different. I mean, it's just one of the variables. But, we adjusted the pH. It was the main thing we did, 40% new oak. And again, we're trying to allow the vineyard site, regardless of which it was, to express itself in the wine. So that's it.
So I chose the Leah Vineyard, which used to be an old Rex Hill site called Jacob Hart. I got to work that in the early 80s. It was a beautiful, beautiful site, and that block had been planted in 1997. It was an incredibly transitional soil. Like Laurent was saying, lots of big boulders out there. It can't be mowed. It can't be tilled. It's just got such heavy rock cover there. The problem with the site is it can be absolutely spectacular one year. The next year, if it's a warm year or a dry year, it can be a real challenge to make wine from that site. I was challenged because I don't have very many vineyard sites at the time we chose to do this experiment that were large enough to provide 7 tons to my friends. So this site was 7 acres. I thought I had plenty of fruit. The experiment took the entire 7 acres because the crop load on this site was very, very small. 115 clone. As far as winemaking goes, I chose to make each lot the way I felt they needed to be made. So I have to admit I cheated a little bit because Steve uses stems a lot in his winemaking. So I thought, well, Steve's vineyard, I'll use stems. Other sites, I used more SO2 versus less SO2, like an 80 part per million addition versus a 35 part per million. So I was really playing around with each individual vineyard site and the way I felt that site should be expressed through winemaking techniques.
So very, very interesting that everybody says they want to express the vineyard, and yet most of you think that it's easier to see the differences between the winemakers than between the vineyards. Yes, one comment over there or a question? Just there.
Pardon me for going back on something basic, but on if you look at these vertically, is the two, one in the front and one in the back, the same vineyard but different winemakers?
No,
or the same,
winemaker,
different vineyards?
Because we've only got two vineyards out of the five here, and we don't yet know which two they are. But, yes? One. Frightfully complicated, I know.
I think Laurent said you use 50% new oak, and Ted said 40. Well, what about the other three of you? Was it 40 for on both? On everything?
60 for me.
So wow. 40, 60. What did you say? 50, 40,
30.
30. There's your clue. I mean, it's going to be so obvious. So one question or comment or guess. Sorry, learned thesis there. from...
I just like to change what you said for our little table here. We were thinking it's... You can see the wine, different winemaking styles, and whether we're right or wrong is one thing. I think it's, we think it's really easy to see the difference between the two vineyards, but hard as hell to guess which ones they are. I mean, from what Ken said, we probably have it exactly backwards. But there's a consistency of vineyard expression being delivered across the two sets. And so I think no matter what they did, we're getting it. You know, we're getting the vineyard, but who knows where it is.
Do you want to have a guess, Thomas, at which vineyards they might be, or just the AVA?
Well, Mr. Wright has too confused me now, and I've been away for too long. But I kind of thought the Flight 1 tasted like Jory, and that I guess I was more hinging on the red fruit there and thinking that might be that was leading that, and the second flight seemed darker, and what I remember, Yamhill Carlton. But I'm also realizing that... Nobody talks about this, but the expansion of Oregon, as you guys are colonizing these hills so beautifully, seems to be going towards the south more than when I was here, and there's a lot more happening in Neola. And I know Bethel and Steve, you guys were always there, but there's a lot of more people sneaking down there. I just, you know, when I have a little spare time, I run out and see that. And I don't know those profiles as well, you know, and what's the Jory doing down there. So I think we're going to learn something when you guys finally reveal.
Well, I tell you what, that
okay,
both...
Okay, we're done. You can go home now.
Both vineyards are in Eola, in the Eola Hills. So that you... But one of them has obviously a different rock formation. So I'll tell them. Should I put them out of their misery? Yeah. So, wine number one is flight number one at the back is Willakaya from Laurence Vineyard. And flight number two is South Block from Bethel Heights. So, anyone like to have a shot at who made which vertical line of wines? Good. Well done. Yes, go for it. Oh, and yes, I've got...
Okay. I'm going to be completely wrong, but I'm going to go for it because that's what you do with wine. First round on the left, moving over, I'm going to say Penarache. Then we're going to go to Ben, Bethel Heights. Then we're going to go to Laurent. And then we're going to go to Steve. And then we're going to go to Ken.
Okay. Anyone else like to have a go? Yeah, that's the next one. Wait till we can all hear through the mic.
Again, just a guess, but I would say... on the left, Bethel Heights, then Penarache, then Christom, then Ken Wright, then Selena.
That's pretty good. Anyone like to correct? He's only got two in transposed there. Anyone like to? Very good. Some lady in yellow behind you for have a go.
Thank you, Mr. Millman. First, we think of Selena, second, Lynn, third, Steve, four, Ken, five, Bethel Heights.
Who said women can't taste wine? Brilliant.
Well done.
Very good. So, yes?
Repeat,
sorry, yes. First one, Selena, Laurence Selena, second, Lynn's Penarache, then Steve's Christom. Number four, Ken Wright, and number five, Bethel Heights. Should I say it once more? So the flight one was Willakaya Vineyard. Flight two was the Southeast Block from Bethel Heights. And then winemaker number one, Laurent at Selena. Winemaker number two, Lynn at Penarache. Three, Steve at Christom. Four, Ken at Ken Wright. Five, the Castiles at Bethel Heights. Any comments knowing that? Yes.
Could you tell us what soils are in those vineyards? Because I don't know what soils are in those vineyards.
So the Willakaya is really kind of in a transition area. In fact, right next door to Willakaya is Antica Terra, which I think has been named for ancient soil. So it's right there as a transition area that Ken described, and again, it has lots of influences of those rolling rocks and the Missoula flood. So it's again in that realm of transition that has more sedimentary influence.
But it's got volcanic as well.
And, it's got volcanic as well, which...
Ted.
Yeah, as I said, our soils on our property are 100% basalt. We're on a south-facing slope. You actually saw a picture of our vineyard. It's a kind of a scary place to farm. But it's about 550 feet. There's a lot of rocks on the ground, but they're basalt rocks, so it's ones that are sort of rusty on the outside and blue on the inside, very hard rock. And the soils that then, you know, come from those kind of rocks are red clay soils. Silty clay loam is the moniker used to describe the soils. They tend to hold water, even though there's only 3 feet of soil, they hold water for the whole season. We've dry farmed most of Bethel Heights after the first 2 years of just watering the vines to get them going. So
the basalt and the sort of very strong black fruits would be going together, whereas the Willakaya vineyard is a little more complicated because it's got a much, much more complex mix of soil types and sort of less obviously fruity.
And on top of it, just adding to the Willakaya complexity is the farming practices made for a very deep ripping prior to planting, 6 foot deep. And so that moved the structure a little bit. And so some of the rocks and some of the roots are able to go deeper faster because of that deep ripping that allows, you know, a great expression of that complex zone.
I think it might be interesting for a lot of people here if either of the really the top identifiers told us how they identified which winemaker made which wine. Maybe we could have a mic over there.
Oh, I have to say I was trained well.
You have to say what?
I was trained very well. I'm familiar with a lot of the winemakers and their styles just from being here in the Valley. And familiar in particular with Ken's wines. So in my tasting, the Bethel Heights, there's a distinct austerity that we found in both. Certainly Ken's with, I loved your word, heady.
With?
Your word, heady.
Heady.
That there's just a real distinctive plushness, gorgeous fruit that comes through that's very clear. Steve, you, my friend, are distinctive as well. There's just this lovely structure and peppery, spicy quality that always comes through. Definite snaps. Lynn, same quality of just tasting it, and it blooms in your mouth. There's this plush, gorgeous fruit that comes through, and it's clear and clean. And Laurent, look at that smile. How can you resist? Again, very clear fruit that has the ability almost to dance over your palate. So I have to say, I cheated a little bit. I'm just familiar with the winemakers. I thought, actually, Leah was a little bit more in number one. That was my first pick. But to me, they're fairly distinctive.
Thank you very much. Comments or questions? If not, no problem, because we're brilliantly on time. There's one from Bonnie.
That was fantastic, the way she said it, and I've worked as a sommelier for a long time, so we deal more often with finished products in a restaurant setting or something as opposed to barrel tasting. We've talked a lot about the collaboration here, but I think what's really fascinating in this experiment is the emergence of distinct personality, where if you're familiar over various vintages with what you expect to find in a given winemaker's style, you necessarily are sort of tasting for that. So for me, the mistake that I made that I thought was interesting was mixing up the Bethel Heights and Lynn's wines. Just stylistically, and I think the word, the transparency and the cleanness, that's what I associate with Lynn's winemaking. So I'm sort of looking for that in the glass. So for me, it's an excellent exercise to not necessarily bring preconceived notions based on prior vintages and really expect a winemaker's style to be the same vintage to vintage. A fascinating experiment. Thank you.
I should say, sorry, yes, we've got two comments there. Okay. Could we have the mic there, please?
No, I was just curious, if you've only gone through four of the vineyards, what are you going to do with a fifth vineyard? And is it going to be another tasting experiment? How are you going to use that?
We didn't show everything because we could only choose four. Right. Because of the logistics of Glassware. And so we decided simply because of that, we had to choose four of the five. Now, everything, you know, it has been bottled, labeled. And these are not barrel samples, of course. These are finished wines. And so they are all five now bottled and then, in fact, available as a set. We're going to be commercial here, but in fact, we are offering these from all five of us. A good part of the funds going to support Parkinson's and in honor of our friend Terry.
All these. Then there's a great leaflet here about this opportunity. Are these available, these leaflets here?
Not here today, but no. From any one of the
from
five
any
of
one
us,
of the, yeah. The bit
we've swapped the all the bottles, so we're right. All selling each other's
they're
ones
the
now.
Gift shop, actually.
And at the gift shop as well here. Thank
but,
you.
But you know, ultimately we would hope it was unfortunate just because there's so many people here that we couldn't do all five at the same time. But that's the way they should be tried, because then you really can change dimensions and not, you know, this accomplished it to some extent, but it'd be really fun to have all five wines by five people and five vineyards. So, you know,
we will be doing some tasting in smaller format, but we will do the five by five.
Very good. Lovely. Well, I thank them. Congratulate all the winemakers for giving us a really great year.
I'll tell you that I feel great because yesterday I went 0 for 10 to my own embarrassment. And so this time I took everything I learned from yesterday, and then I sat with Anna and Lee from Archery Summit and listened to them, and then Dennis from the French Laundry, and I got them all right this time. So I feel much better about myself. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. So, of course, a big thank you to Jancis for moderating, and of course to Lynn and Ted. Ron and Steve and Ken are our fantastic panelists today. Just terrific. Thank you very much, all. A couple of quick notes. In a moment, actually in about 30 moments, you'll have lunch out in the Oak Grove, so you have a little bit of time until that. And then you'll be returning here this afternoon for the second tasting on campus for the DeVogue tasting. Sorry. Yes, exactly what I meant to say. Listen to Whitney on your way. Anyway, we're all going to move out as a stream, so we'll figure it out together. But afterwards, you will return this afternoon back here for the DeVogue tasting, which we know you will enjoy immensely. I do also want to remind you, as I mentioned last night, that the brunch tomorrow will be back here as well as it gets hotter. So thank you all very much, and we will see you outside.
Where's the lunch?
Yes, of course. Yeah.